Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors. Today's episode is about a mysterious collection of stuffed birds. They were found at a high school in a small university town out west, and their story takes us from the prairies of Wyoming back in the 1960s to a fancy research facility today. It's a story about a long-forgotten treasure trove of specimens. But more than that, it's a story about how science works. If you've ever taken a science class, you've probably studied the scientific method, where you start out with a question, you form a hypothesis, you conduct experiments, and then, if everything goes as planned, you get answers to your questions. But a lot of science isn't so straightforward. The path to making a breakthrough is often circuitous, riddled with unexpected twists and turns. When you start a project, you're embarking on a journey that could end up, well, anywhere. Today's story takes us on one such journey. It starts with a storage room full of stuffed birds and shows us the surprising things that can come about from a project that started on someone's kitchen table. The story starts with a man named Brian Barber. He's a biologist, and he's, well, let's just say he's always liked critters.
The very first snake I ever found was in a beer can in the woods by a creek. And I kind of got it out of the can, put it in my hands, and it bit me. And I was, 6 or 7 years old. And rather than being terrified, I was kind of fascinated. I remember going to the elementary school library and checking out all the books on reptiles so I could figure out what it was.
That experience with the snake at age 6 was the start of what would become a career for Brian. Fast forward a few decades, and he's become an evolutionary biologist, a faculty member at the University of Wyoming's Biodiversity Institute. He's also a self-proclaimed bird nerd, one of those scientists who really geeks out over birds. Anyway, last summer marked the beginning of a discovery for Brian, a discovery that was both puzzling and wonderful, and that could have implications for generations down the road. But let's go back to the beginning. One evening last summer, Brian was out for a drink, and he wound up talking with a high school science teacher named Erin. She told him that the high school was moving to a new building, and so she was spending the summer packing things up.
She was moving box after box of specimens and all kinds of things she had accumulated over 10 years of teaching. And she found these boxes that had like stuffed mammals and birds in them and didn't know what to do with them. Nobody in the school wanted them. Nobody even really knew where they had come from or who they belonged to.
Now, the Biodiversity Institute, where Brian works, has a large collection of bird specimens, which they use for research and for teaching. And so Erin asked if Brian wanted the birds she'd found.
I've heard this before. I've worked with museums for almost 15 years now. And usually when someone calls and say they have some specimen that they want to donate to the museum, it's invariably something like, you know, a piece of a deer in a shoebox.
In other words, kind of useless from a scientific perspective. So Brian assumed this would be like that, useless. But he agreed to take a look anyway. So he goes to the high school, meets Erin, and she takes him to the science lab where she's packing things up. One of the tables is piled high with cardboard boxes, lots and lots and lots of them, of all shapes and sizes.
So we just opened one, and it was kind of like Christmas.
Kind of like Christmas. Brian was shocked by what he saw inside the box. This wasn't some piece of a deer in a shoebox. This was a whole bird, stuffed, mounted, and in remarkably good shape. The bird was flat on its belly, wings partially spread, legs splayed out. It was mounted on a piece of plywood. Brian pulls something down from a shelf in his office to show me. It's a largish black and white bird, and like he described, it's mounted on its stomach on a board.
It sort of reminds me of if a penguin were just like doing a belly dive across the ice and sliding.
Yeah, it does look like that. Or it's some kind of weird attempt at trying to be camouflaged and laying flat against a tree.
In case you're not familiar with how bird specimens are usually prepared, suffice it to say, this is not typical. But it wasn't bad. And as Brian opened box after box in this old high school science lab, he got more and more excited.
So yeah, we just kept finding more and more of these. There were ducks and falcons and even, you know, small passerines like robins and bluebirds.
And what was truly exciting was that each of these specimens came with a bunch of information. Whoever had prepared them had painstakingly recorded all sorts of details about where and when the birds were found, their sex, how big they were, etc.
That's very valuable for us from a research perspective because this serves as a voucher. This is a real tangible piece of data that says this animal was found here at this locality at this time and place.
It's kind of like finding a driver's license on a dead body. It gives you real solid information about what you're looking at. And when you have that kind of information, a specimen becomes more than just a stuffed bird. It becomes something you can actually use for science. For example, one of the birds in this collection was a ruby-throated hummingbird. Now, ruby-throated hummingbirds don't usually exist in this area. So without the information attached to it, you might assume it was collected somewhere else, hundreds of miles away. But because it was carefully labeled, you know that this bird really was here at a specific point in time.
So it was actually kind of an interesting record. And so that is research.
Suffice it to say, this collection was a gold mine. Specimens you find in a shoebox in someone's attic almost never have information like this attached to them, which is part of why they're so useless to scientists. But this was amazing. Brian took the birds back to the Biodiversity Institute, where he works, and started going through all of them, figuring out which ones would be useful for demonstrations in the classroom, and which ones were valuable from a research perspective. He points me back to the bird in his office, the one I thought looked like a penguin doing a belly dive. He shows me a typewritten label, which is pasted onto the wood that the bird is mounted on. The label has all of the information we've been talking about, details that are useful from a scientific perspective.
The common name, the scientific name, a location about 1 mile west of Laramie, Wyoming, May 7th, 1964.
But it also has one other piece of information.
The collector and preparator is D.R. Tyndall.
D.R. Tyndall. Brian had no idea who this guy was. He was just sort of a mysterious benefactor. But then, one day, the question was answered. Totally by accident. It happened because a woman who worked across campus at the library was taking a tour of Brian's building.
Up on third floor, I think it was, there was a room, and one of the other gals on the tour said, "What are all those birds doing on the table?" And I walked over there and looked at that and thought, oh my gosh. I said, where did these come from? And the gal on the tour said, oh yeah, we got these from the high school. I said, you've got to be kidding. This is my dad's collection.
Sure enough, this woman, whose name is Diane Trotter, was the daughter of the man behind all these bird specimens.
My name is Dave Tyndall. And I'm an ex-teacher, a biology 2 teacher.
Dave, as you may have gathered, is still alive and well, and still lives in Laramie. And sure enough, he's the man who, decades ago, made this collection.
I spent the whole summer hunting birds.
This was the summer of 1964.
And my wife would chauffeur me. And I'd see a bird sitting on a post, and that was one I didn't have, and she'd maneuver over and bam, we'd get it.
Dave is so casual about this exercise, I almost had to laugh. But he goes on to tell the whole story. It all started because Dave had convinced the high school to let him create and teach a new upper-level biology class. But he didn't really have any materials for that class, not even textbooks. So he decided to make a bird collection, among other things, to use as a teaching aid.
So I petitioned both the federal government and the state Game and Fish and got permits to make a bird collection. They hadn't given out any permits before.
In the whole United States?
Yeah, there, I don't think any high school ever had a bird collection.
So Dave gets permits for his collection and spends all summer hunting birds. He collects lots of them, more than 100. Little did he know where this summer of hunting would end up. Unbeknownst to him, Dave was embarking on a project that could have a life far beyond his high school biology class. But again, that's often how science works. Anyway, I had to wonder how Dave actually made this collection. Like, once he'd killed a bird, then what? Turns out it's a fascinating process. Far more low-tech than you might imagine for specimens that have lasted this long.
I'd shoot the bird and skin it and treat the hide and then stuff it with old mattress, clean old mattress stuffing that I'd get out at the dump.
So were you preparing all these birds at your house?
Yes. Yes, I skinned most of them on the kitchen table.
And what did your wife think about that?
She was used to that.
This wasn't the first time Dave had turned his kitchen into a science lab. He'd done a rat project where he anesthetized rats and mounted their skeletons to use in the classroom. And then there were the rattlesnakes.
We found a place where the rattlesnakes hibernated. And we went out there and captured live rattlesnakes, put them in backpacks. This was my good friend and me. And took them to the freezer and froze them.
Like just your kitchen freezer. This is what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, it had. Well, it were two freezers, weren't there, Connie? One pretty much for me.
For the snakes and rats.
Yes.
So, yeah, you are understanding this correctly. Dave was trying to put the snakes to sleep by freezing them in his kitchen.
We took the rattlers out because I wanted to go down the rows in the classroom and show them all about the teeth, which were the fangs, which were the replacement fangs, where the sensory organs were and everything. And we got them out of the freezer and got ready to go over to school, and the darn things were moving. So we had to refreeze.
But back to the bird collection. That's Dave's daughter, Diane, the one we heard from earlier. She's imitating a meadowlark. She had her dad for class when she was in high school, and she says all the students had to learn how to imitate bird songs. They also had to learn how to identify all the birds. Dave used the stuffed birds in his classes for the rest of his teaching career. They were a staple for high school biology students for years. But then, eventually, Dave retired. The birds didn't belong to him. After all, his permits were specifically to make a collection for the high school. So the specimens stayed at the school. But subsequent teachers lost interest in them, and eventually they got packed away into cardboard boxes and piled into a storage room. And that's where they stayed, until Aaron found them last summer and showed them to Brian Barber. So now, back to today. I take a trip to the University of Wyoming's Biodiversity Institute, where Dave Tindall's specimens now live and work. These birds, which were stuffed on Dave's kitchen table, now live in a slick, modern facility. They're stored in a large, sterile room, along with hundreds of other animal specimens. It's the kind of place where temperature and humidity are carefully regulated, and there are rows upon rows of cabinets, sort of like a vault.
So we've got a pinion jay. collected about 11 miles north of Laramie, Wyoming, in May 15th, 1964.
That's Beth Womack, who manages the collections at the Biodiversity Institute. The cabinet she's showing me houses some of the more rare specimens from Dave Tyndall's collection.
We've got an eastern kingbird. We have a ruby-throated hummingbird, which is a really rare count. These guys aren't actually supposed to come this far west.
That's the hummingbird we talked about earlier, the one that was so surprising to find in Wyoming. Back in Brian Barber's office, I ask what the future holds for Dave Tyndall's birds. Brian says they're already being used in the classroom to teach undergrads. But moving forward, the possibilities for research you could do with specimens like this are almost endless. For example, you could look at interbreeding of closely related species. And then there's all sorts of fancy DNA analysis you can do.
The technology with DNA has gotten so good now that you can extract it from century-old specimens, right? So you can go into a specimen collected by Darwin and scrape a little bit of a toe pad off and get DNA from it.
But what's most exciting are the possibilities we don't even know about yet. It's possible that scientists will find all sorts of new uses for specimens like this down the road, things we can't even imagine now. It wouldn't be the first time that's happened. For example, Brian tells me the story of a well-known case involving a mysterious slump in bird populations, a poisonous insecticide, and an amateur collector. It started back in the Victorian era, when people would go around collecting birds' eggs. They'd find a nest, steal the eggs, and keep them.
You'd have guests over and see the things I've collected.
These people weren't experts, just civilians with a lot of time on their hands. Collecting eggs was a hobby. So anyway, this was going on, but then something disturbing started happening.
Yeah, so in the early part of the 1900s, in response to mosquitoes and insects, we started spraying DDT. So DDT is an insecticide, and what happens is it accumulates through the food web. And so if you, an insect, and you get eaten by a bird, and that bird eats thousands of those insects, they get a little bit of DDT, a trace of DDT in each insect. And so they're getting not necessarily lethal doses, but enough to impact their physiology.
It was around then that biologists started noticing that some bird species were declining. As in, there just weren't as many of those birds around. They figured this was related to DDT, but they didn't know quite how. Like, what was it about DDT that was so problematic?
It wasn't outright killing the birds. You weren't finding adult birds laying around.
And yet, something was happening to make the bird populations shrink. So they looked into it a bit more. And what they started to find was that there were a lot of crushed eggs in the nests.
Which is kind of odd. You're trying to raise young. You're not going to smash the eggs. And if a predator gets into the nest, they're usually going to take the eggs out, or it's obvious that it was a predator. Where these just looked like they had been kind of smashed. And so the guess was that the eggs were somehow thinner or affected in some ways.
The thought was that if the eggshells were thinner than usual, it would be easier for them to break by accident. But in order to test this theory, they needed to compare current eggshells with past eggshells, ones that were laid before DDT was being used. So they tracked down an amateur ornithologist who had a big collection of eggs, and he let scientists measure the thickness of those eggs. And sure enough, they found that prior to the use of DDT, the eggshells were thicker, and then around the same time that DDT became used in a major way, the shells became thinner.
And so that was just additional evidence that was kind of instrumental in getting governments to reconsider the widespread use of DDT.
So I usually think of science as being, okay, we have a question that we want to answer, and then we conduct experiments to figure out the answer to the question. But with something like this, these eggs, this guy who was collecting the eggs obviously wasn't setting out with a specific question like that. This sort of happened by accident that it was, that the stuff he collected was useful. Is that, like, how often does that happen?
Well, I mean, we don't always know what the future holds as far as research, right? So birds have been collected, specimens have been collected for hundreds of years, and they were collected before we even knew about DNA. So we still collect specimens under the idea that technology will improve and somebody in the future, hundreds of years from now, or maybe some kid in fifth grade class right now, will be able to do some analysis that we never imagined.
And that's what makes the discovery of Dave Tindall's collection so exciting. Here's this collection that was assembled decades ago as a teaching tool for a high school biology class. Dave had no idea that one day his specimens would end up at a university, that they could be used for advanced research projects. But here they are, being carefully preserved so that future generations of scientists will be able to answer questions we can't even fathom right now.
I've never had anything like this happen where, especially just by chance, somebody's touring our building and recognizes their father's specimens from the 60s, and now they're being used to teach undergrads and could be used for research in the future. It's kind of a nice storyline.
A nice storyline, yeah, but it's more than that. It's a testament to the power of preservation, and a reminder that something you do today, just because, can have major implications down the road. That a project for a high school science class could end up helping us unlock scientific secrets decades or centuries later. That the things we do today matter in ways we may never understand in our lifetimes. Today's story was edited by Lee Patterson. She's a reporter with Inside Energy. Also, special thanks to Ryan Thompson at KUNC for production feedback. Before you go, I have some wonderful news. We met our initial fundraising goal much faster than we ever expected. A huge thank you to Reese Kidd, Kennedy Penn O'Toole, Becky Jensen, Mike Lutters, William Egerking, Jenny Cuenca, Annie Stenzel, and Corey Harai, among others, for pledging their support through Patreon. You guys make this show possible. Looking ahead, we would love to produce Out There more frequently for you. Right now, we're doing it twice a month. But of course, some months are longer than others, so sometimes there's a 3-week gap between episodes. We'd love to do the show every 2 weeks, and our next goal on Patreon is to raise an additional $300 a month so that we can do just that. So, if you're excited by the idea of getting your Out There fix more often, and you haven't had a chance to pledge yet, make a pledge today. You can contribute whatever amount you want, and it doesn't have to be a lot. A dollar a month goes a long way for us. It's super easy. Just go to patreon.com/outtherepodcast and choose an amount to contribute. You'll have our eternal thanks, and you'll also be eligible for a bunch of different rewards, including discounts on Out There gear, free t-shirts, and more. We, of course, have a link to all of this on our website as well, outthereshow.com. That's it for this episode. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.